Welcome to Beyond the Checklist, the podcast where we explore the latest trends, news, and innovations in pharmaceutical manufacturing. I'm Robert, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Brad. Hey, Brad, good to have you here.
Robert, good to be here with you. I think we have a great episode lined up. Had a chance to sit down with John Kaufman, kind of talked about the intersection of quality, innovation, of course, AI. I think it was a great conversation, but we'll get to that here in a few minutes.
Great. I'm looking forward to that. John's got a wealth of experience, and I'm sure he has some strong takeaways. But first, let's dive into what's happening in our world this week. Brad, you've been tracking a big shift in the regulatory space around continuous manufacturing. What's the latest?
Yeah, with John, I had a chance to talk a little bit about continuous manufacturing. You know, that landscape continues to take shape. In terms of industry guidance, we had the ICH Q13 guideline, which lays out that science and risk-based framework for implementing continuous manufacturing. You know, that finalization happened a couple of years ago back in 22, but a lot of the major regions already implementing that guidance, others kind of still working their way through their implementation schedules. But then more recently, the WHO, the World Health Organization, they followed that guidance up with their own draft guidance just a few months ago. And that really kind of aligns and harmonizes with Q13. Really trying to help regulators, help manufacturers across the world, especially in some of the developing markets, adopt those new continuous manufacturing approaches.
Yeah, it feels like we're at a tipping point. For years, we've heard about continuous manufacturing as the future, but now the regulatory pieces are really falling into place to support it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Q13, it takes those QBD, those quality by design principles that we've been familiar with for a number of years and really, you know, builds on those specifically for continuous manufacturing. So you're looking at real-time process monitoring, dynamic control strategies, and moving towards things like real-time release testing.
Yeah, and from a regulatory standpoint, that's huge. It means we're moving away from rigid batch-based expectations towards something more flexible, but still grounded in science and process understanding.
Right. That WHO guidance kind of takes it a step further, really putting that framework that's more globally applicable, maybe a little more digestible to some markets. So not just tailored to the high-tech manufacturing hubs, you know, the big boys, but also countries with more of a developing regulatory system and just trying to make those technologies, you know, more accessible, more approachable, really across the board.
Yeah, and that global harmonization is key. That's been talked about for many years. And it makes tech transfer smoother, regulatory submissions more predictable, and opens the door for more innovation. But it also requires a shift in mindset, especially around validation, traceability, and digital infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. Continuous manufacturing, not just about running your line nonstop, but you're making real-time decisions, having a robust data analytics process, and I mean, really just a new approach to defining what a batch even really means.
Yeah, definitely. And I imagine some of those themes came up in your conversation with John Kaufman today.
John brings great perspective on innovation. And of course, AI mixed in with that is reshaping really how we approach quality, and not just from a day-to-day operations standpoint, but, you know, kind of a forward-looking strategic standpoint.
So let's jump into that interview. Here's Brad with John Kaufman talking about quality, innovation, and the role of AI in the future of pharmaceutical manufacturing.
Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Checklist. Today, we've got a great conversation lined up with John Kaufman. John's a co-founder and CTO of Quinn AI. A little bit of John's background. John's career includes leadership roles at Thermo Fisher Scientific, Elanco, and Eli Lilly before launching Quinn AI, which is using artificial intelligence to improve deviation management in pharma manufacturing. John, appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor. I appreciate it.
I guess, you know, kick things off, you certainly had an impressive career from quality roles to Lean Six Sigma roles at Lilly Site Leadership at Elanco, and now founding your own company. So maybe just take us back a bit, kind of what originally got you into this industry and how that path kind of led to where you are today.
I've wanted to work in an industry that had impact, and I couldn't think of a better industry than pharmaceutical manufacturing. You think about the amount of impact you have on people's lives and patients' lives across the globe, and you get to do that every single day that you walk into the plant. And so I started off my career knowing that I wanted to do something like that, and eventually was able to get into a role at Eli Lilly and Company in the quality control testing lab. And from there, I was able to grow within the organization through higher level responsibility roles within the global quality organization at Lilly. And then at the time, Eli Lilly had a program around Lean Six Sigma. And basically, if you went into that program, it was a leadership development program. And so I was asked to join the Lean Six Sigma program there at Lilly. And through that process, I learned how much I really enjoyed process improvements, the methodical approach to process improvements, and really embraced the tools and enjoyed that role. And then right around the time that you take those roles, you spend about 2 to 3 years in those positions. And right around the time that I was going to approaching that 3-year time limit, I graduated from business school and I wanted a role more on the business side of things. And so at the time, Elanco, which was a business unit of Eli Lilly, was growing rapidly through mergers and acquisitions. I think we did like 13 acquisitions in 7 years. And so it was quite a lot of activity, and they had a role on their M&A integration team. And so I joined as the quality and manufacturing lead on the M&A integration team there at Elanco. And then Elanco decided to kick off basically their global lean program, which is a little bit different than Eli Lilly's Lean Six Sigma program. And I jumped at that opportunity to launch the lean program across all the manufacturing plants at Elanco. And it was right around the time also that has kind of a 2 to 3 year time limit on it. And so right around the time I was getting close to the end of that, they asked me to take an operations role. And so I took an operations role, which I'd been on the quality side for about all my career at that point, and was pretty excited about jumping into the operations. So I took an operations role, really enjoyed that, and implementing kind of the tools I'd learned through Lean and Six Sigma as well, improving those processes. And then they asked me to take on a GM role for a vaccine manufacturing plant. And that's about the time that Lilly spun off Elanco as a wholly owned subsidiary through an IPO. And I stayed on the Elanco side and then took that site head role. And after a few years in that, an opportunity came along at Thermo Fisher, which was a CDMO. I'd never worked for a CDMO before. That kind of excited me. The work pace was different. And it was with the new technology, some monoclonal antibodies, which I hadn't worked with at that point. And so I took that role, leading their monoclonal antibody production operation here in St. Louis, and then kicked off Quint AI.
Great. No, I appreciate that background. Obviously, your role has changed a lot, both within organizations and between organizations over the years. The industry itself certainly has changed as well. I'm sure you've seen that shift. So I mean, just thinking back to your early days, I mean, what are some of those big shifts that you've seen, notable shifts that you've seen in the industry over your career?
It's a really interesting question. I wanted to have a flippant response and say that I haven't seen anything different in the industry in the last 20 years. But I think about it, when I first started out, we were like every conference I would go to and most of the major papers I would see, we're talking about personalized medicine and how the industry was heading towards the personalized medicine space. And so I've seen a lot of changes with respect to that, with CGT and nuclear medicine. Those have been some significant changes within the industry. I would say also, I've seen an acceleration in adoption of technologies. And I say acceleration relative to what it was before. I don't think it's the same speed with which you see in some of the other industries. But I think that gets to my last point around it. And that's from a macro and economic perspective. The biggest change I've seen in my career has been we're talking a lot more about cost effectiveness today than we were when I first started. When I first started, the margins were significant and it felt like money was free and you had a lot of resources available to do a lot of different things. And a lot's changed from a political perspective and a customer expectation perspective on cost. And so I've seen a lot more pressure. And so a lot of the things that we accepted as being were acceptable, I guess, in the past, when you had higher margins, are not acceptable today. Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to see a lot more pressure on loss rates, starting to see a lot more pressure on overhead expenses associated with the production operation. And I think that is what's driving a lot of what we're seeing today with respect to adoption of AI and other technologies, and really the driving force behind this pharma 4.0 movement that we're hearing is that the industry or the customers and the political environment have told us that we've got to do better. We've got to reduce the cost in order to maintain our ability to produce medicines.
Well, yeah, we kind of said the magic word, AI, obviously nearly impossible to avoid in all walks of life and certainly a big topic within pharma. So I guess keeping on that thread, you know, relative to AI and pharma, you hear a lot about AI potential, so sort of across all industries. You know, in terms of AI impact within pharma, maybe some areas where you've already seen how AI is impacting pharma today.
Yeah, so I think that probably the biggest places that we're seeing it, well, I mean, everyone's looking for use cases. So I don't think there's any question about that. I think that where we're seeing the most adoption is within the R&D side and the sales and marketing side of the business. I'm not an expert in either one of those areas, but at least when I look at the companies, when I'm doing market research on the environment that we're playing in, that's most of the companies are servicing the R&D and the sales and marketing side of the business. I know when I was in the operation, I saw the QC space adopting a lot more AI from a data analysis perspective, data throughput of results. Within the QC space, I saw a lot of adoption or more adoption on the QC side. Within the manufacturing side, I have not seen a lot. Where I have seen it has been mostly in the verification. So if you're doing like line inspection, real-time inspection of the processes, I've seen it kind of in some of the low-hanging fruit areas with respect to document preparation, document completion, those types of things. Hear a lot more about it getting into kind of the other side of the, like predictive analytics and predictive maintenance and troubleshooting, real-time troubleshooting. I haven't seen a lot of that yet, but I hear a lot about it, but I haven't seen a lot of it actually in implementation yet. I do think a lot of that has to do with the fact that you need a constant stream of data. You need a data pool in order to for those tools to be effective. And we still have a lot of companies or a lot of manufacturing sites that are that have disconnected systems. And so getting that data together so that then one of those tools can become effective or efficient is kind of the first challenge.
Yeah, I think that maybe addresses some of the elements of this question, but just, I guess, John's crystal ball, the next 5 to 10 years, right? I mean, the potential curve of this adoption is probably hard to even fathom sitting here today compared to this conversation a few years ago. But AI in this space, say 5 years down the line, just from the trends that you've talked about, some of the potential next use cases, kind of what you see the space looking like?
Yeah, I do think that probably, I guess, the most traction it's going to be getting, at least from what I can predict, is going to be, today we're still seeing a lot of batch processing within manufacturing. And there's kind of, I think in the future, we should be seeing a lot less of that. And in order to have that batch, in order to have that continuous manufacture, continuous processing, you need a lot of really good controls and the ability to make decisions very rapidly. And so I think we're going to see a lot of it when, with respect to the implementation of that continuous manufacturing process. I think that couples or goes along with, I do see real-time batch release as well as being one of the use cases where if you collect enough data and you've got enough information along the process and you've got the you've collected it in such a way that has been approved or validated, qualified, you have the ability to release batches at the completion of that process. And so I do think there's going to be a lot of use cases around that coming up. I think that the predictive analytics with respect to identifying and reacting to issues before they become issues is another big significant use case within manufacturing. Likewise, predictive maintenance, I see that as being another pretty big use case within the manufacturing space. I think a lot of things have to happen in order to get to those. In order to get to real-time release, you're going to have electronic documentation. You're not going to be able to do documentation on paper. You're going to have, in order to do real-time kind of predictive analytics along the process, you're going to have sensors and data collection devices within the manufacturing process that then are being collected and stored someplace and being analyzed someplace. And that doesn't necessarily exist today. So those are kind of be in the latter half of the 5 to 10 years. You know, I think in kind of the earlier side of things, I think anywhere you see documentation, where people are preparing documents and putting documents together, I think most of that will be switching over to AI very soon. That's one of the things that our existing AI platforms are your general kind of LLMs are very good at doing. And I think that that's kind of your first set of use cases. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I think that performing deviation investigations, documentation associated with that would also be what I would see companies embracing over the next 5 to 10 years as well.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. We see that a lot in our line of business with the generative AI and how it can help with document preparation. And yeah, I mean, the real-time release, obviously big topic of focus on a lot of conferences for many years. So definitely a great goal.
We've been talking about it for many years, right? Like we were talking about real-time release. I was at a plant in, I don't think Italy, I don't know, 15 years ago with Lilly, and they were talking about implementing everything they needed to do real-time release for that specific plant. And last I heard, they're still not doing real-time release. And so, I mean, that's just what I've heard. We've been talking, like as an industry, we've been talking about these things for a very long time. But I think with the AI tools, it becomes easier to implement. There are barriers or challenges to making some of these things happen that with AI no longer exist. And I think that's what's going to actually make it happen is the ability to eliminate those barriers, I guess, to make it a reality.
You mentioned deviation management. So talking about that for a bit, something I know is near and dear to your heart, but you know, maybe those that aren't as familiar, just talk about the importance of dealing with deviations in pharma manufacturing and just their impact on quality compliance.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the one thing I don't think people realize is that, or recognize, I guess, is that about 10% of the batches that pharmaceutical manufacturing companies manufacture are not manufactured according to their procedures that are put in place. And so we discussed a term called right the first time. And if you're a really good company, you've got a 98% right first time. If you're not so great, it's below 90%. And so that literally means that if your right first time is 90%, that literally means that 10% of the batches you manufacture weren't manufactured according to your procedures. And when that happens, you have to stop and document why it happened, what is the root cause, what's the impact of the product, what's the impact of the patient, can this product be released, how are we going to prevent it from happening in the future. You have to go through this really systematic process from beginning to end that's required by the regulatory agencies before you can actually release that batch to the market, or in some cases, not release that batch to the market. Why that's important? One, it ensures that everything that we release to the market is safe for our patients, safe for the patients. And so you have to go through this, you validated a process. And if you go outside of that validation, that means there's a question about the safety, identity, purity, SysPQ of that specific product. And you need to prove that it's safe for the patients and it will do what it's supposed to do. And that's what this process is. So that's one reason why doing these is really important. And another reason is you want to make sure that it doesn't happen again. If you make a mistake, that's bad, right? But if you make the exact same mistake again, that's really bad. And so you perform these investigations and you put in kappas to make sure that those same deviations don't happen again. Because every time a deviation happens, it costs the company money. I mentioned you can't release the product until that deviation is closed. That's working capital. And in some cases, that's product that could be shorted on the market. And so a patient may not get what they need when they need it because there's a deviation holding that product from hitting the market. And so it costs companies a lot of money, not just in the time to investigate, but it costs them a lot of money in terms of recurrence. So it happening again costs companies a lot of money with respect to lost sales and brand impact. So that's on that side. And then there's on the regulatory side. If you consistently show that you're not able to manufacture your product according to the process that you've registered, the regulatory agencies say that they use a term called out of control. And you don't want that label because if a regulatory agency determines that you're out of control, they shut down your operation. And so these deviations are an important opportunity for you to bring the process back into control so that you don't have those regulatory impacts. I'll say that one of the top two findings from the regulatory agencies today is companies failing to perform thorough investigations. So failing to determine root cause for the deviations and failure to create good kappas to prevent them from happening again in the future. So even when companies are performing these investigations, they're not necessarily doing a complete or effective job. And I don't want to say I understand because it's really bad, but the fact is there's a lot of pressure for the folks on the floor to complete these investigations and do it in a timely manner. And I think sometimes that drives them to cut some corners. And that's what the regulatory agencies are coming back and saying, you got to stop. You can't do this. And so tools like Quinn AI are helping to standardize that process so corners can't be cut. But it's also helping them to do a more effective job at identifying root cause and implementing CAPAs that prevent recurrence from happening in the future.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the different evolutions within the industry, both in terms of, all right, moving from large batch to personalized medicine, obviously, you know, the role of AI, other technologies, but you were talking about the regulatory oversight part. So curious, different expectations that you've seen in those inspections from the various agencies and seen an evolution, different set of expectations as the technology using the manufacturer has evolved and changed and new technologies have been invented and what you're seeing on that side of things.
Certainly. I think that we started off, I don't know, several years ago where CSV was the big thing, right? Whereas when you had the agencies come in, they're really nailing companies for CSV because companies were adopting more computer control systems within their operations. And the FDA wanted to verify that you had clear, validated computer systems beyond CFR 2111 compliance, right? Beyond your kind of your standard compliance activities. They want to verify that the software did exactly what it said it was going to do when it said it was going to do it. So that was when technology was kicking off. It's still a big deal. Now it's more along the lines, you hear more of the data integrity piece associated with it. So that's where they start talking about, okay, your system does what you say it's going to do, but is the data that comes out of it, one, is it right? Is it what it's supposed to be? And two, can anyone change it? Can it be affected by a human being or, in some cases, when you talk about AI, by the system itself? Is it doing anything to the data? And so really being able to have that conversation and talk about that, you know, one, our system is doing what it's supposed to do, and two, the data that's coming out of it is true, right? It meets all the standard Alcoa principles associated with data. And so I see a lot of that. I think there has been a shift around the risk-based assessments for your computer system. So kind of going from CSV to more of a CSA kind of approach, right, where you start talking about these are the risks associated with it. This is how we've tested the risks. These are how we're going to mitigate the risks, and taking a more of a risk-based approach. I think we're starting to see more of that from a regulatory agency expectation, I guess, if you will. That is actually, if you look at the guidance that the FDA put out with respect to AI, that's kind of the approach they're taking with AI. Is rather than the traditional validation kind of language, it's more around the CSA type language. Right. It hasn't been approved yet, but that's kind of the, at least in the draft side of things, it's kind of the way, the direction it looks like they're taking is basically that AI today as it stands is not validatable. It just isn't, right? It's a bit of a black box today. And so the question is, knowing that it's a black box, how can you ensure that the data coming out of it or the information coming out of it is, you know, meets Alcoa principles? And so it's setting up those processes to verify that risk-based approach, to verify that or ensure that the results coming out are what you need them to be.
Let's talk a little bit about AI. I mentioned it a few times earlier, but obviously, you know, starting your company is a big leap. Just curious what led you on that path after spending, obviously, a lot of time with some big pharma players, animal health players.
Yeah. So it's interesting is that everywhere I've been, at some point or another, there's been what we call a deviation backlog. And quite frankly, when I talk to my friends at other manufacturing plants or other manufacturing companies, they are occasionally, frequently plagued with the exact same thing. And so this term deviation backlog continues to pop up. And a deviation backlog just means that really in the end, you've got more deviation, you're creating more deviations than you're closing in a given month, which means that your net number of deviations is actually going up. Now, you're still technically in backlog until you're total number of deviations in WIP are below the number of deviations that you close per month. But nonetheless, in the end, there's this concept of this deviation backlog that many companies are plagued with. And those deviation backlogs happen for multiple reasons. A lot of times they happen because some perturbation in the system happens. A lot of times that perturbation is caused by an audit. or some other event that occurred at the manufacturing plant that then results in this deviation backlog. I've been on the unfortunate side of owning a backlog a few times in my career. What happens when you have a backlog is there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of pressure because that backlog both represents one of your highest regulatory risks, meaning if an agency were to walk in and see that you have a backlog, you are more than likely going to get a 483 observation for it. So one, it's a ticking time bomb. Two, it's also a ticking time bomb because you've got a lot of deviations you haven't resolved yet, which means the chances of recurrence happening is significantly higher. So you've got to get those closed that you can prevent recurrence from happening. And I've been in a situation where there was a deviation, we hadn't closed it, we hadn't implemented a CAPA, and the exact same deviation happened again. And unfortunately, in both cases, it was loss of product. That is a hard pill to swallow when you're in that scenario. And so those two, and then on the third piece, that represents batches that aren't being released to the market. And so there's a lot of pressure to get these deviations closed. There's never enough time, not enough resources to actually get that backlog closed, which means you have to act differently. You have to operate differently. In many cases, it means bringing in outside resources to come help close these deviations for you to get you back into a stable state. But I think a truism behind it is the fact that most companies or most sites that have had a backlog and gotten out of a backlog find themselves back in a backlog situation at some point in the future. And so it's a cyclical nature. And I was in the midst of that, and I knew that there were ways to accelerate the process in a way that did not put compliance at risk. And basically, it was a matter of looking at the process, identifying where your waste was in the process, and eliminating it. And at the time, one of the tools that had just come out was ChatGPT. And ChatGPT, one of the things it's really great at, wrong or indifferent, is writing. And you could literally take a deviation that you had spent 2 days working on and drop it into ChatGPT, and it could write the thing in less than 2 minutes. Like, what an awesome technology, right? This thing is really cool. The problem is it wasn't validated, right? Nobody knew how to validate it. Nobody knew what the response was going to be from the agency if you used it. And so here's this tool that we could use to help us out of this backlog situation, but we weren't allowed to use it because of unknown regulatory hurdles. Now, that was back in the day. And now with agentic AI, like, the capability and the power of those tools is significantly higher, but yet companies aren't using them to get themselves out of these backlogs because of, like I mentioned, some of those barriers, the unknown about from a regulatory perspective. Well, the unknown are just something new. And as this industry's pretty conservative when it comes to adopting new technologies, it's difficult sometimes for them to grasp onto them and take advantage of them. So the point is, like, in the middle of the backlog, saw an opportunity, knew I couldn't use it, got frustrated, decided to do something about it, left my job, started a company so I could do something about it. That's, like, in the end, what it comes down to. And I think that's pretty much the impetus behind a lot of folks creating companies, because they see a problem, get frustrated that's not being solved, and decide to do something about it. And that's what I'm doing with Quinn AI.
Yeah, I mean, we've all used ChatGPT, and you can see what it's doing, and you can see its power in daily tasks. In terms of this industry, you kind of touch on these points with, how do you validate that? Can you validate ChatGPT? I mean, not really.
No, you can't.
So I guess you kind of covered this a bit, but just the difference between using a dedicated tool, right, purpose-built tools, just applying a DIY generic AI solution, sort of how that plays into. As I say again, the purpose-built functionality of AI to kind of be able to put a saddle on it a bit.
Yeah, put a saddle. That's a great way to put it, right? Put a saddle on it. I love it. We like to use the term guardrails, right? Put guardrails around it. But I think there are lots of kind of concerns. There are lots of, opportunities when it comes to using the purpose-built systems. I think that one, first and foremost, I'm not a believer that AI is the answer to everything. I think that you need to use AI coupled with traditional coding, coupled with traditional processes together, because I think that when they work together, you end up with a much better solution. And so trying to use one of these large LLMs that are commercially available, right? You can't use kind of that traditional coding with it. It's either prompt engineering or it's not, right, is what it comes down to. There's some that you can do with it with various APIs, but in general, that if you build one in-house or purpose-built, you can get kind of the best of both worlds with both the AI and the and that traditional coding. I think the reason why that, one of the reasons why that's important that we've been finding out is doing a lot of this work requires a lot of data. And data is expensive when you run it through one of these massive models. And you use a purpose-built system, it becomes a lot cheaper to run it through a purpose-built system. You don't need one that's as big as one of these major LLMs to do a specific function. So the cost to run your data through that model is much cheaper. And so that's one good reason to use the purpose-built model. Another one is you can put those, I mentioned those guardrails, right? You can put those guardrails on the model if you use a purpose-built one. And I think that you, what we're finding it as well is kind of lose some of the hallucinations when you use a purpose-built AI model. And you still have hallucinations, but you have fewer from our experience, at least when we're doing it. And then, you know, if you use a purpose-built model, it's yours, right? And so that's another issue is the other day, one of the major LLMs went down. If your whole system is built on one of those major LLMs and it goes down, you have no control at that point. And so if you do a purpose-built one, you can have it on a chip, right? And so you're at much less risk of it going down. And then, like in the end, your models are only as good as the data that you train them on or tune them on. And if you have a purpose-built model, you can train it or tune it on a specific set of data so that it's not looking at the whole world, right? So it's looking at that specific set, and the results that come out will be much more directive to whatever function you're applying it to, which also makes it faster too, by the way, in that when you do that. I think there are a lot of good things from this large LLMs, but there are a lot of really good advantages from having some of those smaller purpose-built dedicated models.
Well, I guess as we move towards wrapping up, just kind of a whopper of a question maybe, but just your take on where the industry is headed, fast forwarding 10 years, just the biggest differences in what, you know, pharma manufacturers approach quality, yeah, approach compliance in particular.
I think that right now there's a lot of companies that are, I like to talk about the AI market or AI within the industry as being like a high school dance, right? And so you've got a lot of companies that are sitting on the sidelines, watching to see what other folks are going to do, watching to see what the response will be from the regulatory agencies, watching for kind of something that buys down the risk for them in their minds. And so they're just kind of watching. And then you got the other folks that are on the dance floor, but they're really just dating, right? They're just dabbling their feet in it to see, they're taking a use case and they're implementing AI for a specific use case and not really like making it part of their overall strategy for how they're manufacturing. And then you got the folks on the dance floor that are going to probably, they're going to get married. They're going to have kids by the time they're 18 and they're going to die together at some point in the future. Right. And those are the early adopter companies that are really wrapping their entire strategy around AI and manufacturing more effectively. I think that those companies are the ones that are ushering in the pharma 4.0. Those are the ones that are really embracing the concept of the fully automated, fully, I guess, transparent manufacturing operations to run a lot more effectively, a lot more efficiently. That takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of mistakes, a lot of mishaps. But those companies are going to show that ultimately, in the end, that's how we're going to manufacture medicines faster, more reliably, and in the end, it will be cheaper. And what we're going to start seeing is that as that's proven, as that's shown, you'll have a lot more companies jumping in and embracing that as part of their strategy. I think one of the problems with that is that if those other pharma orgs are already super far ahead, it's going to be hard to catch up. And so I believe that what we're going to see is we're going to start seeing your companies with lower profit margins. They're going to have to embrace these types of technologies in order to manufacture more efficiently, in order to manufacture cheaper, in order to compete in the market. and you're going to start seeing a lot more adoption on those ends. I think you're going to start seeing your major innovators are probably going to be a little bit slower to adopt it on the manufacturing side. They'll get there, but they're going to be a little bit slower to adopt it, I think, in the end. But I do, going kind of back to what I talked about earlier, I think that the biggest opportunities that I see are going to be within manufacturing that I think we'll see in 10 years is going to be on that automated batch release. It's going to be on the predictive analytics within the process. It's going to be those technologies that allow the continuous manufacture of, you know, product rather than the batch manufacturing of product. And will that be in 10 years? I hope so, but that's, I actually believe that it's going to have to be, again, to, in order to continue to compete.
John, we appreciate you joining. Great conversation. Obviously talked a lot about AI. I mean, clearly changing the game, not just in our lives, but pharma is certainly no exception. But good to learn how tools like Quinn AI are and helping lead that way in harnessing technology to improve quality. Obviously, that's where we need to be. We want to be able to trust what we're taking, right? And that our loved ones are taking. I guess before we wrap up, just any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners?
When do you see that? Where do you see the manufacturing industry in 10 years? I mean, that's, I guess, ultimately.
You mentioned continuous manufacturing, something that we talked about with Lilly. I mean, Lilly was an adopter of that quite a few years ago. I certainly see that being a major driver, just moving from this concept of batches that seems potentially archaic when you look at, you know, what some companies are already doing in that continuous space. Personalized medicine, another thing that's been in the conversation for a long time, obviously cell and gene therapy and how those technologies have grown, radiopharma, another huge growth sector of that market, something that we've seen sitting here in central Indiana, a ton of growth in that radiopharma space. So, you know, those are the types of industry sectors and technologies that we certainly have an eye on as the industry evolves. And obviously, the AI technology really sprinkled throughout all those things and probably use cases that we haven't even considered yet that we're going to see on the forefront here shortly. So, exciting times.
Well, I mean, I've heard that you've adopted a new AI technology as well for some of your work, right? And so how's that working out for you?
Yeah, so you know, you'd mentioned the kind of the use of the generative technology on the document development side. So in our world, that's kind of the name of the game is validation, verification. So being able to, in some cases, not shortcut by any means, but be able to fast forward the development, being able to digest manuals, technical drawings, functional requirements, and quickly distill those, the salient points into a testing methodology. There's always, at least today, kind of a human in that loop, but it can cut out a lot of the legwork and a lot of the grueling hours of pouring through documentation to distill functional requirements into a testing document. So that's something that we're working with today. And we see a lot of folks in the industry similarly situated as us doing the same thing. So we can focus our efforts on the more important stuff, the quality and compliance side versus the legwork side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you mentioned that, like the ingesting those documents, right? So we had a deviation at one of my plants where the bioreactor basically was, it started consuming oxygen, like it just started consuming, so the demand for oxygen kept skyrocketing. And so when you have a bioreactor that's consuming more oxygen than it can get, basically the first thing you think is contamination. Yes. And so that's the first line investigation pathway you run down. And the problem with that is that you got to make that decision really fast or you're going to lose the batch is what it, well, if it's contaminated, you're going to lose it anyways. But if you spend all your time and effort chasing down contamination, you could end up losing the batch if it's something else, right? And so had we had the P&IDs in the system, like within some sort of AI system that could quickly identify what are some investigation pathways you need to run down that aren't just contamination. I know contamination is the obvious and the, what everyone expects, but what are some of the investigation pathways that you could chase down that are not contamination? For this specific deviation I'm thinking of, it would have gotten us to the answer much faster and not put that batch at risk. And those are multi-million dollar batches in those bioreactors that we were running. And it turns out for that particular deviation, it wasn't contamination. It was that one of the bypass valves was off on a manual bypass valve was off on the bioreactor. And so it was calling for a lot of oxygen and it looked like it was consuming a lot of oxygen. The DO was plummeting. So it looked like something was consuming all of the oxygen, which in fact something was. It was the actual culture that we expected to be in there, what we wanted to be in there, but it looked like contamination and it was just a bypass valve. And AI could have spit that out. Did you check the bypass valve? It's like, yeah. No, we didn't check the bypass valve because we didn't even know it was there, but it turns out, right. I mean, we knew it was there, but I mean, it was, nobody would have expected because they thought that the most obvious answer was the answer and it wasn't. It wasn't, it was something else. And like I said, it put that batch at risk, but had it been able to consume that PNID, give us a troubleshooting pathway, we could have gone down both pathways and fixed the problem very quickly and not wasted a lot of effort and put the batch at risk. So you got some of the power that these tools have, the ability these tools have to improve operations across the site or across manufacturing plants. I look forward to seeing them in use in the future to help reduce some of the angst that happens on the floor when those things happen.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think with that, it's a good point to wrap things up. Appreciate you joining us for this conversation. You appreciate those that tuned in. So enjoy the conversation. Make sure to follow the podcast, to share with your network, and you appreciate everyone tuning in and listening. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Performance Validation, your validation partner for what's next. Best-in-class, cGMP-compliant validation for pharmaceutical, biotech, and medical devices manufacturing. With more than 3 decades of experience, Performance Validation helps you streamline using innovative approaches that balance production realities with strict regulatory requirements for quality, safety, and compliance. Learn more at www.perfval.com.